Bonjour à tous, nous accueillons maintenant Oscar Horta.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. Thanks for your time and for your interest in this talk. And thanks also for your activism, because if you are here, that means that you are activists and you are concerned with this. Will there be translator or sorry, I'll just speak? What?
Now we translate directly.
Ah, okay. Oh, cool. Okay. Cool. I will try to. Slowly. Okay, well, thanks. So, this is about the strategies we can follow to help non-human animals. And this is an extremely important topic that is seldom addressed. And the consequences of what we decide here are extremely relevant, because they can mean then that a lot of suffering and a lot of harm for animals can be saved or instead can take place. So, I start with this. We have here a challenge, which is we have this aim. We want to help animals most. We want to give them the biggest help we can, but we have limited resources for that. So, to see this, we have this concept here, regarding how we can meet this challenge. And we have there the idea of efficiency, right? Effectiveness is how we manage to attain our aims. But this is not only about effectiveness. It's about doing what's effective, but in the best way possible. That is, by achieving the best ratio between the results and the means we have, right? So this is going to be all about that, right? And because someone can say, well, you know, I'm doing this and this effective, or I think we could do that and that could be effective. Well, that's fine. But maybe it's not the best efficient way to do it, right? And in a cause like ours, not being efficient has a cost. And it's not us who pay the cost, but rather it's animals. And we somehow indirectly too, but it's them we are more concerned with. So in order to see the problem we are dealing with, the first concept I like to introduce here is this of cognitive biases, right? So you have there the explanation of what this concept is about. Cognitive biases are patterns of thinking, right, that lead us to behave in an illogical, irrational way. And we have lots of them. Psychologists have studied this very much. By the way, is this slow enough, or am I still? Okay. So the way in which these cognitive biases impede that we achieve our aims is double. The first one is that they distort our perception of reality, right? So this drives us to not be efficient, right? And the second one is that they drive us also to have a wrong evaluation of that which is actually valuable, right? So I'm going to put some examples here of the biases we have, and I haven't chosen them just because I find them particularly interesting, but also because what I see is that these biases are very much into action nowadays, right? And they alter significantly the way we make decisions. So the first one has to do with our ends, that is, the aim we achieve at, right? We aim to achieve. So I say here that some biases lead us to pursue wrong ends. And I'm saying wrong, which is a very strong word, right? And why I say they are wrong? Well, this can happen in two ways. First, they can be suboptimal, right? Suboptimal means that they can be pretty good ends, you know, we attain them and that is good, we help animals a lot, but they are suboptimal because we could have done more, right? So for instance, I may stop, I don't know, 1,000 animals from suffering, but maybe I could have stopped 1,001 animal from suffering, or maybe 1,000,000 animals from suffering, right? And then sometimes we have irrational ends, right? So we aim at something that is not really the proper aim we should have if we behaved rationally and if we thought deeply about the issues. So there are several biases. So here's one. Bias towards solving the problems we see and not those problems we don't see. even if we know about them, right? So this bias is the one that leads us, for instance, to invest lots of resources in helping, say, some animals that we happen to come across that maybe need our help, but not helping others that may need our help much, much, much more, and that they are hidden or that they are in other countries or that they are in places in which we just don't, we fail to imagine how their plight is, right? So, well, unfortunately, the slide, well, you can't see it very well, but that's meant to be an eye that is just looking there and we fail to see what's behind. Anyway, so there is another bias which is also very, very important. I don't want to say that it's maybe the most important of them, but it's definitely one of the most important. And it's this one, the failure to appreciate and contrast high magnitudes of harm, right? This happens, for instance, like in the news. When they say the news and say, well, in an earthquake, 100 people, they always mean human beings, even if other animals they are dying in earthquakes as well, but they say 100 people have died. Oh, that's terrible. And then they say, no, 1,000 people have died. Oh, that's terrible. Their reaction is just the same. But this shouldn't be definitely so. And in the case of animals, well, this happens just in the same way, right? So, well, again, the slides can't be seen very well. I'm sorry about that. But, well, that's a fishing net, right, in which we have this hell of a lot of animals. They're suffering and dying, right? And this is interesting because, for instance, when we talk about veganism and not harming animals, and they say, well, the animals killed in slaughterhouses, right, are so many, like it's around 60 billion today. But, well, it's been estimated that more than maybe 3 trillion animals, aquatic animals, are killed by humans every year, right? So we fail to appreciate this. And of course, this is even more clearly if we consider the fact that the number of animals that are killed in vivisection is estimated to be every year about over 100 million. The number of animals killed for fur is about 50 million a year, right? The number of animals that suffer in, say, circuses or bullfights and everything, that's some thousands sometimes, some tens of thousands, you know? So there's clearly an asymmetry here, clearly. So even if we achieve just a tiny change regarding the suffering that these animals are undergoing, that would be hugely, vastly more important than, for instance, abolishing other forms of animals exploitation by humans. And then I have this other picture, and this you can't see it. And it's a pity because this picture will appear again. You probably don't see anything there. It looks like, I don't know, like rings or something, but they are the eyes of newly born or newly came into existence animals in nature. So there are a bunch of fries, they are called small fishes. And I will explain later why this is important. But for now, I just want you to see this picture or to not see this picture because it's important to this problem we are tackling about magnitudes of appreciating magnitudes. So that's the second bias. And then the third bias is that we have a bias towards stopping negative actions against animals over doing positive actions to help them, right? And this is a bias that is very common, not only in our field, but in others too. And this is a very significant one, because an animal can be suffering from a harm that we are not causing, but rescuing that animal or helping that animal may be just as important as not harming the animal. Not only that, I mean, there is actually no reason, it's quite irrational to have this focus on not doing something negative for them, because the reason for that action should be ending the harm. So it's the harm that is important, not the action that we carry out. Okay. So, for instance, we have here, well, again, you don't see it, but it's a baby who, suppose that is a baby that is drowning in water. should we help the baby or not help the baby? Well, of course, it seems that we should help the baby, even if we are not the ones who are drowning the baby, right? I don't know if Adriano later is going to speak about this, because I've heard him or seen him, I've seen him speaking about this in his interesting talk, so I'm looking forward to see what he says. But for now, we are moving on. And then we have, again, other biases that lead us to dismiss the interests of some animals. So, for instance, we value more cute animals over non-cute animals, right? So you are all familiar with this picture. But apart from that, we also value more the interests of big animals. We have there a calf over small animals. So there's this rat there. I chose a picture of a rat that it was not a very, very cute rat, but you don't see it, or you don't see her. And then, well, that's another animal that you failed to see. Sorry about that. And here we have again these very, very tiny, tiny animals, right? So intuitively, most people will think that it's more important to save the life of, say, 5 elephants than the life of, say, 5,000, sentient invertebrates. But this is clearly implausible. Okay. And then this is also another very, very important bias. And, this bias is about having preference for the animals that live today instead of those who will live later. And unlike what it may seem, this bias is far more important than the other one. Because this bias affects a huge number of animals, much more than the other one. Because the animals that will exist in the future are impossible to calculate, right? So the vast amount of animals that are involved here makes this bias one of the most crucial ones. So this is important, particularly due to this. So here you have this light cone shape, and it represents how ideas, attitudes, and practices spread through time, right? So if we start to spread veganism here, right, at some time, it may be 1944, or it may be the 19th century, where Louis Gomper, before Donald Watson, started to talk about not using animals, then the idea starts to spread. So as time goes, the idea spreads more and more, right? So the thing is, suppose we can decide whether to do an action, to carry out an action that will help a lot of animals now, right? Such as, say, prohibiting, banning a certain way in which animals are used, right? Or instead, we have a much more ambitious aim, but which seems clearly unattainable today, right? There are lots of people who go for the first, because they say the other thing is irrealistic, unrealistic. We can't attain it, so we should go to what we should attain. And that's how things have been for many years. So, for instance, when the first animal protection groups started in the early 90s, they were concerned about the conditions in which horses were kept, horses for transport, right, in the city. So they could have certainly done some advances on this. But, you know, now the work on that is not so relevant. After all, I mean, we don't even use those horses any longer. But guess what? Suppose they started to spread anti-speciesism and veganism. I mean, 200 years ago, would we be in the position in which we are now? Of course not. We would be far ahead than we are now. So this is easy to see when we consider the past, but we have to see it when we consider the future, right? We fail to appreciate the importance that these have, the importance of the future. Because in the future, even if we now talk about the billions or trillions of animals, the magnitude that could then be used to name the animals that are involved may be vastly more than these ones. So it's definitely important that when we consider what to do, we don't think of how animals are now. It's far, far more important to think how they may be in the future. So that's why the unrealistic fight, unrealistic struggle claim should be completely left aside. Okay. And then finally, this is a very important issue too, that we have somehow a bias towards domesticated animals over wild animals, right? So we are concerned with domesticated animals. And many people think that just, well, you know, the aim of our movement should be that all animals should be just in the wild as wild animals are, right? But because they are believed to live great lives, right? And this is asymmetric with regards to the attitudes we have towards humans, right? Because respecting humans is not only about not killing them, about not exploiting them, it's also about the positive rights they have, the right to be helped and all that. So we'll tackle this later. For now, I just want to mention that idea. Okay, so then we have other cognitive biases that are important to take into account here, which are those that lead us to choose the wrong plan, right? A plan that doesn't work optimally, right? It's not only that the plan doesn't work. I mean, the plan actually may work and actually may be effective, but it's going to be maybe less efficient than other plans that we could use. So what biases we have here? Well, the first one is wishful thinking. So we think that things are the way we like them to be, right? And confusing the actions we find attractive with how effective they are, right? So for instance, when we want to talk about our struggle, this is a common symbol that is used. Yeah, let's go for it. Because it's an attractive one that people can be identified with, right? So it's an attractive one, we like it. So we confront oppression, we do this, right? So I appreciate definitely the feeling that is there, right? But of course, who's gonna fight with her or his fists against oppression? You don't fight with your fist against oppression. And if you do, you are following a suboptimal strategy, which is somehow, well, you know, a way of saying that you are kind of nuts. No. This is the tool we should use. But it's interesting that this is not used as a symbol of our struggle. That's kind of weird. Because that's what you fight with, right? So then we have wishful thinking, and we have another bias that is conservatism bias. And this is another important one, which is we have certain beliefs, certain assumptions of what to do. Why? Because we have been educated in our movement, right? But then we are faced with new evidences, and we fail to reappraise our previous beliefs. And so we fail to consider new hypotheses, especially when they are like a very, very new, brand new hypotheses, which present to us a completely new scenario. We fail to appraise those new hypotheses correctly, right? And this is, this is obviously a problem, because it's almost sure that we are not right, right? So, and I'm saying this, and this may be a paradox, but I'm sure that I may be speaking here for 2 hours or 4 hours or whatever, and it's impossible that everything I say is right. I'm sure I will make mistakes, but I'm sure you are making mistakes too. It's not that all we say is mistaken, right? But there may be mistakes in what we think. So we have to rethink everything, all the time, and be open to new possibilities all the time. And then the generalization bias, right, which is related to the other ones. We have certain experiences, and we generalize it. And we think, well, this is representative of what happens everywhere. And this is just not so. And I'm going to rush because I think that I may not have time to... How much time I have for this? Okay, then... Well, then I'm not going to take my time anyway, because even if you don't care... I care that Adriano and also other people like David are talking later, so let's be a bit altruistic with them. So then we have the ambiguity effect. And this is interesting. So there may be good options, right, that are available to us, but we fail to appraise properly their probability, right? So we don't know how probable a scenario may be. Right? So because of that, we think, well, that's not really a scenario we have to consider. But why? That needn't be so. Suppose, for instance, that someone say, well, you know, animals are suffering from disease in nature, and that's a bad thing. Maybe we could help them overcome these diseases. Oh, but that's not impossible. That's not possible. That's very unlikely. What's the probability of that being successful? No, no. So we skip completely out the idea. Well, there's no reason to do so, especially if the effect that strategy could have would be significant. So again, it's all about this, right? It's all about the fist here representing what we like, what we have been identified with, and the brain, which leads us to say, okay, I'm probably mistaken, so I'm going to rethink again everything. Right. So once we are we have the idea of overcoming our biases and of thinking rationally about how to struggle for what we aim to, we may reach the idea that what we have to do is follow strategic thinking. So when we think about what should our ends be, we are doing ethics, right? When we consider, okay, I have to care for sentient beings, I have to reduce the suffering that is in the world, that's our ends. When we think about the ways in which we achieve our ends, that's something different. And that practical part of it is what strategic thinking is about. Strategic thinking is about making decisions that concern the way in which we can attain our end. And regarding that, we have to introduce these concepts, strategies and tactics. So strategies are about the plan we have to achieve our aims, and tactics are about the particular plans we have to achieve each of the steps the strategy has. So it's like a stairs, right? Well, you can see it here, but this would be some stairs, right? So I want to reach that place there. I want to get there. So how can I do it? So the stair is the strategy, right? The stairs are the strategy. And each of the steps there, right? That's what the tactic is about, right? And of course, apart from that, we may have different techniques, we may have different courses of action to implement that tactic, right? But the plan is about that, right? So, once we have seen this, we can consider what are the different strategies that currently in the anti-speciesist movement, although some people don't want to call it anti-speciesist movement. They may call it the animal rights movement, or some people call it the veganism movement or the vegan movement. I prefer to call it anti-speciesist movement because what is bad is the fact that we are discriminating against non-human animals. And discrimination is a comparative concept, right? Right. So, for instance, suppose that I like to help people, so I help European people, and I also help, say, African people, but I help African people less because they are African. That's discrimination. That's bad. We don't want that, right? So it's not just about veganism. It's about something else, right? So, as I said, there are three main approaches that there are for helping animals today. And the first one is these legal changes. Many people think, well, what we have to do is achieve legal changes in the way they are. So they may be of two kinds. First, legislation, certain uses, certain practices involving the use of animals. And the second is trying to achieve a recognition of legal rights to them. Because humans are protected with legal rights, right? So it seems that it's discriminatory not to have other animals protected as well. So when it comes to the first group, there are two different strategies that can be followed there. One is the one that I've called regulationism, that is about regulating, reforming the ways in which animals are used, but without ending them altogether, right? So for instance, Happy Meat is all about this. Or incremental prohibitions. So we're going to prohibit now, I don't know, wolf fights. Then we're going to prohibit, I don't know, circles with animals and so on, right? And then we have the second group. And there we can have a campaign that aims at achieving full legal rights for only some non-human animals. For instance, I don't know, great apes or cetacea. And then we can do the same, but focusing on all animals, not only these particular groups of animals, right? Okay, so there are some objections that can be presented against this, right? Because it may be claimed that we can never succeed in this as long as we live in speciesist societies. So as long as that speciesist attitude that most people have and is prevalent and is institutionalized in our society, it's unlikely that we're going to achieve significant legal changes. We'll just achieve minor legal changes. But we should remember that cone, that light cone shape that we saw here, right? In the long run, in the long term, is this going to be the most effective approach? We don't know that. I mean, there are reasons to doubt it. And then there is this second approach, and the second approach doesn't focus on law. It focuses instead on the production of animal products and service, right? That is, on their actual exploitation. So there are several different courses of action that can be followed to achieve this. So, for instance, we may go on saving animals directly from their exploitation. We may make difficult the use of animals. I don't know, for instance, we could make some harm, some damage in some animal factory, say. We can make campaigns to close down the business in which animals are exploited. Or, well, some people claim that what we should do is try to change the whole system production, make a social revolution, and then abolish animal exploitation, right? And, well, regarding these strategies, the same ideas that I mentioned before may be considered here, right? The fact that, well, we have to look at whether these strategies would be optimal concerning all the animals involved in the future, too. Some people have argued also that some of them may be counterproductive if people don't understand why we are doing these actions and they may not want to listen in to us. But, well, I'm not going to tackle those particular objections. I'm more concerned with the general framework of the discussion. And then the third strategy has to do with changing the public's attitudes regarding the discrimination and the exploitation of non-human animals. That is making a huge change in the way in which our society sees animals or non-human animals. So there are two approaches here. We may focus on affecting the demand of animal products, right? So we don't want people to buy animal products or services. And the second one is not to be focused on that, but rather to be focused on the attitudes themselves, rather that is speciesism itself, right? So if we consider the first group, there are different courses of action that we could follow. So first one is we could try to communicate the public the idea that they should stop using animal products and services for reasons that do not have to do with animal interests, such as health and all this kind of stuff, if we are considering what we eat, or, I don't know, cultivating a virtuous moral character if it comes to, I don't know, shows or whatever in which animals are exploited, and so on. And then there are these two other strategies that focus on animals themselves. The first one would be to reduce the demand for animal products and services by making vegan products very available to everyone, so people will easily buy these products, right? Or we could say because we should be concerned with animals, we shouldn't buy animal products and services, right? And we can do this even if we, don't challenge the current view of non-human animals. We can just say, well, you know, it's cruel how animals are used. I mean, this goes clearly against their welfare, so this shouldn't be done. So you don't need to speak at all about the moral status of animals or about speciesism there. Just say, well, you know, this is cruel and it's unnecessary, so we can deal without it, right? Okay, and then we have the last approach, which is basically changing the consideration non-human animals have, right? So there are two ways to do that. The first one is educating the public. I mean, and by educating, I don't mean doing talks or going to schools, but I mean doing things that educate the public, like, I don't know, demos or performances that have impact in the media or stuff like that may be equally good to educate the public, right? The issue here is that we aim at is changing the view of animals that is prevalent in society. So again, we can do this without questioning speciesism. We can simply say, well, you know, we should consider animals more than we do now. So of course, if we do this, that entails that we shouldn't be using them, and that it will entail also something else, that we may need to help them and all that, without even questioning speciesism. But we can do the same by introducing this concept, this idea of speciesism, right? So, what can we say about all this? Well, to see this first, we can consider what are the cause-effect relations between the different orders of the animal or non-human animal discrimination and exploitation system. So we have that because we have speciesist attitudes. We demand animal products. This is not that I think I'm a speciesist, so okay, I'm a speciesist, so I can use animals, so I use animals. No, no. The very fact that I eat an animal and not a human, that is speciesist, right? So this definition of speciesism doesn't mean that first we have like the mental sphere and then the way we act. No, when we act in a speciesist way, we are thinking speciesistly. We have a speciesist mind frame. Okay, we demand animal products, and because we demand animal products are produced. And as a result of that, animals are harmed. And apart from that, speciesist law is accepted, right? So the legal system depends on socioeconomics. So because we have a system that exploits animals, we have speciesist law. And speciesist law makes it the case that animals are not protected. Unlike what happens in the case of humans, because I can, if I want and I have the money, I can establish a business which consists in growing animals and kill them. This is perfectly legal. I can do it. But of course, I can't do this to humans, right? So if we consider this, we may have reasons to support the idea that our focus should be at the highest level, that is, upstairs, right? Then we can consider also the fact that in line with what we saw before, speciesism, in addition to our biases, means that we don't care for animals and means that we don't help animals when they need it, right? Which is also important. So animals suffer from harms that we could avoid, right? So all this seems to suggest the idea that questioning speciesism may be probably the optimal strategy to follow. But as I said, I mean, we are all mistaken. I may be mistaken. So maybe this is not so. But the reasons we have drive us to think this, right? I'm not defending this because I like the word speciesism, or because I like to, I don't know, put city stalls in which I hand out leaflets to people and speak about speciesism rather than other things. There are other things that are far more enjoyable, right? And the things that we identify with other courses of action, I definitely think are far more enjoyable. Absolutely. But it seems that we have some reason to do this, right? Okay. And then in addition, we have to consider again this cone. I mean, this is so important. I mean, if I had to choose a single slide in the presentation, you're thinking now that I'm saying I would choose this one. Well, I don't know if I would choose this one, but this would be a fair candidate. Because of the reasons we saw before. Suppose we are in 1813, right? And we can decide whether to question speciesism, whether to fight for the abolition of horse carts, or whether to fight so horses will be provided more resting hours, right? We are now in 2013. We can now assess which of these outcomes may have a highest net impact. And it's absolutely clear that questioning speciesism has, right? So, as I said before, we have to look to the future. So it seems that the lessons we can learn from the past has to be applied, have to be applied immediately, actually. Okay. So, having said this, I want to make it clear that there may be things that we would do to carry out other strategies that are good for this strategy of questioning speciesism as well. So we need to consider here, as I said before, the difference between strategies and tactics. So remember the stairs, right? It may perfectly be the case that I follow a certain strategy that is a wrong strategy, but my tactics work pretty nicely to achieve the aims that I have when I follow that strategy. So the problem is not with the tactics. It's with the strategy. Or it may be the other way around. I may have a good strategy, but the tactics I follow are very poor, right? Or again, it may be that certain tactics can be used to different strategies. And for instance, we wouldn't follow them to if we were focused just in one strategy, because maybe that strategy is not a good one, but can be used for the good of a different strategy. So we need to consider all that. But even if we accept a certain course of action, we have to know very, very well why we are following and what is the aim we want to follow with that. Because even if the tactic is the same, depending on what the strategy is, the message we may convey with it may be completely different, right? So, for instance, you don't see that, but that's a... someone guess what that is? No. Yeah. Well, it's a rescue, an open rescue of an animal. So that rescue could be done just for the sake of the animal herself, right? And this is often defended, right? And of course, I appreciate the spirit with which this is done, and I fully see the people who are doing this as my how do you say this in French? The compagnies, a lot. Oui. However, there are different ways in which this can be done. This can be done for the sake of the animal herself, so no light cone there at all. Or we can do it, for instance, with the media. So we go with some national TV channel, we show them a farm, and we say, okay, we're going to make this symbolic rescue of these animals because, see, they want to live, and they don't want to suffer, and here, look how they are. So would we accept this to be inflicted upon us? Certainly not. And by doing this, what are we doing? We are probably questioning speciesism, right? Of course, it all depends on what we say. We may say, well, we're doing this because we believe the conditions in which these animals are awful, right? That's implying that if they were in a better conditions, that would be fine. But we may do this and use the actual term speciesism. I mean, we've done this kind of stuff in Spain, and we've been saying this in national TV channels. Well, this is an instance of speciesism, which is discrimination against animals for this reason and this reason, right? So this just intends to show that we have to analyze what tactics we are following, and we may give them a new meaning in the appropriate context, and with the appropriate message, right? And I'm now finishing my presentation. There are some slides, but this is like the last part of it. We should remember that this is not about what we want, but about what is more efficient. And again, this idea. I'm sorry, I'm repeating it again. And you may say, well, this is boring. I mean, why is he doing this? Well, because, you know, it's those who talk about education say that if you repeat the message, you repeat the slide, you get more highest result, right? So that's why, I mean, in relation to this, that's why you should be all the time repeating speciesism is arbitrary, speciesism is like racism and sexism, and non-human animals can feel suffering and pleasure just like us, so we should take them into account and all that, right? So this is the way of, you know, making people learn about that. So this is like when for instance, you have an interview and the journalist is asking all the time different questions. You don't reply the questions they want you to reply. You reply them what you want to say. So no matter what they... No, this is true. I mean, this is very important. I mean, people go to interviews sometimes with the wrong assumption that the point of an interview is replying to what they are asking you. It's not. It's about saying what you have to say. And there has to be like three ideas, very clear ideas, and you have to repeat them all the time. So what is this about? Well, this is about this performance that we've done, this action we've done, because we believe that animals shouldn't be exploited because speciesism, blah, 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 blah. Are there many people in your movement now? Well, yeah, more and more people are starting to realize that speciesism should be left. This is what we have to do all the time, right? So, again, I mean, you're not going to read it all again, but I'm just putting it just to stress the importance of bearing these biases into account. And I actually, well, I'm... Okay, well, I have this this handout, but hell, that's the wrong one. Jerome, I gave you the wrong one to print. It's all my fault.
That's okay. You can put it on the...
That's my fault. But I have a summary of this. So if anyone wants it, sorry, it's my fault. Shame on me. Okay. I've been inefficient and ineffective. Okay. I'm mistaken. This proves my case that we are all mistaken. Okay. But anyway, at the end of it, I'm going to put my Facebook contact and all that. So if any of you wants this, I can send it to you, the summary of it. But anyway, I just want you to have this in mind, to rethink this and to be aware of those biases and to wonder whether at some point we are actually victims of those biases without, of course, noticing, right? The biases that lead us to dismiss the interests of some animals, the biases that lead us to have the wrong ends, the biases that lead us to have the wrong plan, okay? So, having said this, I just want to end with a point regarding this that is very important. And I previously presented the case of these biases that lead us not to consider appropriately the magnitude of harm that may be out there, or those biases that lead us not to consider appropriately the interests of animals living in the wild instead of domestic ones, or not to consider those situations in which we can not just stop causing harm, but helping animals not to go on suffering harm. And a clear example of this is the fact that while vegans tend to focus on animals such as she or he, who definitely need help, they tend not to focus on the interests of other animals. And, well, I said before that these were like tiny fishes, right? And, well, the appropriate way of saying this in English would be tiny fish, you know, because fish is uncomfortable. But we are against that because fishes are individuals, so we say fishes, which is maybe grammatically wrong, but it's good for animals, so we do it. We ponder grammar, animals win. So there we have a bunch of animals, right? And this is interesting because many animal activists are not aware of this, of the fact that there is much suffering in nature that is analogous to the suffering that many humans suffer. And when it is humans that are suffering, we aim at helping them. Whereas when it is animals, we just left them to their own devices. So, for instance, these are fishes that have just come into existence, and most of them will die soon. This is how things happen often in nature. And we're going to see why this is so. But first of all, I want you to see this picture. But again, you don't see the picture. Well, this is a koala in a fire. You probably, some of you at least may have seen this picture. And maybe you can see it, some of you here. Can you see it?
Yeah.
The guy looks a bit like Eve. Yeah, he looks a bit like you, Eve. So, you know, it's this koala it's a koala in a fire that has survived, and they're giving him or her a bit of water, right? So this is an unusual picture, isn't it? But it wouldn't be unusual if instead of a koala, we were speaking about a human, right? But most people think that, well, I mean, we shouldn't be concerned with animals in nature. I mean, even animal activists tend to think this. But how come? I mean, we can help that animal who is in need of it. Why shouldn't we do it? And then we have this other picture. And this is a picture you may not... you probably failed to see what's about. Okay. This is in Tanzania. Every year there is this circle-shaped like migration of thousands and thousands of animals, right? So there will be wild beasts and zebras and others. And they have to cross the Mara River. And every year a whole bunch of them die, right? A whole bunch of them die because they fail to reach the other side of the shore. Sometimes the reason is simply that the shore, you know, in order to reach them, the gap is too steep. So they fail to reach it. So, as I say, every year we have a picture such as this one, and you may not notice what this is, but all this is a bunch of dead animals, right? And this is a case that is much celebrated by environmentalists, and every year they are going, lots of tourists there to take pictures of it as an environmentalist attraction, right? And this could be quite easy to avoid, right? Of course, I mean, we have to monitor how to do it. We have then to look at that, these animals don't reproduce too much, so maybe some other systems could be implemented. But whatever we do would be absolutely much better for them than being dead in their thousands, right? And as I said, this could be very, very easy to avoid. I mean, you just have to do some work there and that's it. And this is a picture that, again, you don't see. It's a picture of a deer that is dead. And this is a recent picture. This is a picture which was took like a month ago or 2 months ago, something like that. It was in Spain. And, this animal died, as many other died, for lack of food, right? Because of the snow, it was very difficult for them to be fed. And, unlike this, in other parts of the world, there are people helping those animals so they don't die, right? Again, something that we can do. And this has nothing to do with veganism, by the way. Because this is not about not harming animals. But this is certainly what we would do if we were anti-speciesists, right? That's why I say that veganism is great, but we have to move further. And then there is this picture. This is taken from a scientific paper published in a scientific journal. And you can see clearly there the title, Vaccinating Wild Animals Against Rabies. And I want you to see the date. The date is 1988. So this is not a recent paper. So this has been done for decades now. So in the US, for instance, and in other countries, vast areas have been covered with vaccination against rabies to animals. And the way they do it, I mean, this is amazing. I mean, but it's actually the way it is done. And it works. So I know it sounds unbelievable, but it works. They go with helicopters and they throw these biscuits with the vaccine, which are very attractive to animals such as raccoons or wolves and other to eat. So they eat it and they get vaccinated, right? And thousands of these animals have been vaccinated, right? And why are these programs carried out? Well, so that these animals don't pass rabies onto domesticated animals or to humans. But the fact that this is carried out shows clearly that this is something perfectly feasible that we could do for the sake of animals themselves. So when we talk about intervening in nature to help animals, we are not talking about science fiction at all. We are talking about something that we have been doing for decades already and that is actually successful, right? And this is not only done in the case of rabies. This is done in the case of many other diseases. Like, for instance, and it is done, for instance, in national parks, some national parks which want to have their flagged species animals. So they are taking care of them. They are feeding them so they don't starve. They are providing them with water so they don't suffer from thirst. They are vaccinating them. So, of course, intervention to help these animals is feasible. And, of course, it's something that we should do. And then, finally, to get an idea of the importance that this last point is, I want to mention just a brief note that shows how relevant it is that we take this into account, which is that many people have what I call an idyllic view of nature. They think nature is like a paradise or something like that. But it's not. I mean, animals are suffering. And the idea that can help us to see more clearly this is R selection. Many of you, I guess, does someone know what R selection is? Okay, well, some people do. Well, R selection is this. Different animals in nature follow different reproductive strategies, right? So there are some that have one child. I know they don't use the word child to name the son and daughters of animals, but we saw before that animals are more important than language. So, too late. So, well, I can explain you what this is about. So the thing is that they just have one child and they take much care of this child, right? So this is what happens, for instance, in the case of humans, in the case of great apes, in the case of, for instance, elephants, and in the case of many other animals. But then most animals don't follow this reproductive strategy. Rather, what they do is the other way around. They have a bunch of children. Usually what they do is they lay lots of eggs and they take absolutely no care for them or little care for them. So this is the strategy that the overwhelming majority of animals follow, right? So invertebrates, fishes, reptiles, and then even birds and mammals often use a combination of both strategy, like dogs, for instance, follow a combination of them. So, well, dogs are more K-selected. K-selection is the one that is you have a small amount of children that but take care of them. But still, they don't have just one children, right? Anyway, so what happens is this, that most animals have huge clutches. Like, for instance, frogs may lay like 10,000 eggs. Some fishes can lay a million eggs. So on average, only one of them survives, one per parent. The rest of them, they die. And most of them die when they have just come into existence. So they just are born, hey, here I am. Is there food around? No food? Oh, I'm hungry. I'm die. Or others are die for other reasons, for whatever. They are eaten by others, whatever. So their lives contain very, very little enjoyment, if any. But they contain a significant amount of suffering because they die in pain, right? So, and then adult animals often suffer greatly for a bunch of reasons, such as disease, as we saw, injuries, harsh weather condition. Like, for instance, we are now here, and well, I won't say that this is like being in, I don't know, the Caribbean or something like that, but we are covered, it's more or less okay. But some meters from here or some hundred meters from here, there are animals who are getting wet and they don't like it, but they suffer it because that's the way they are, right? So the thing is that there is much more suffering than we think it is, and we may not be able to solve it all. We definitely can't solve it all, but we can solve some of it. So why not doing it? And again, even if this, at least at first, may seem implausible, which is not, because we have seen that there are some programs that have been put into practice, even if it were implausible now, well, who knows about the future? I mean, remember the Litecoin. We should go in that direction. So, again, you don't see the picture. It's a panda bear. For some reason, she wants to get up there, and there's the other one helping. I don't know if you see that. And I'm just putting this picture. You're going to see it in this side. You don't see it. Sorry about that, but you do. So now you are being discriminated against. I'm doing this so you can get a picture of what being discriminated against is when you are a non-human animal. Okay, so so that's it. So to conclude, what the hell is this? Yeah, the concluding remarks are basically, as I said before, we need to reject our biases, we need to reject the speciesism, we need to reject suboptimal causes of action. Even if they are effective, we should be more effective, we should be efficient. And we need to be bold enough to rethink everything, right? To accept new evidences and to not just, as I said, adopt those strategies that help animals, that which work. We don't want to do that works. We want to do that works best, that help animals most. So that's it. Thank you. And if you have any remarks...